Morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It's May 24th, 2022. We're ready to start the third matter on our oral argument calendar. We're proceeding by Zoom as noticed to the parties in this case. And I see that counsel for both sides are present and ready. And your connection has been checked. So I'll just make a couple of quick remarks. Actually, before we do that, let's call the third case. All right. Thank you, Mr. Marshall.
Now calling case number A21-1221, State of Minnesota versus Ramona Lissa Brown.
All right. And counsel, you should be able to see the clock on your screen now, and you'll want to keep a close eye on that since our conversation tends to go quickly. The court does maintain an audio recording of this oral argument on its website. And so we ask you to identify yourself as well as the client you represent before you begin your remarks. So with that instruction, let's proceed. And counsel for appellant, you can begin when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I am Sarah Martin. I represent the appellant, Ramona Brown. Ms. Brown was charged with 14 counts of theft based upon allegations of Medicaid fraud that occurred between October of 2012 and December of 2015. Seven counts for theft over $35,000 and seven counts for theft of public funds under $1,000 for the same time periods within that span of just over 3 years. The court found her guilty, or the jury found her guilty, excuse me, of all 14 counts. Ms. Brown raises four issues on appeal. Today, I'd like to address the inconsistent verdicts and the sentencing departure issues. The seven guilty verdicts for theft over $35,000 were legally inconsistent with the seven guilty verdicts for a theft under $1,000. Verdicts are legally inconsistent when proof of one element negates a necessary element of another offense.
I want to stop you there, Ms. Martin. I'm looking at this. I'm looking at the guilty verdict on count two. And it, as I understand the jury instruction, that, you know, it seems like there's more consistency between counts two and one, because in both situations, for the same period of time, you had a jury saying, yes, there was a theft by false representation. There was aiding and abetting theft by false representation. And it was more than $35,000. Or said another way, it wasn't under $1,000. What's inconsistent about those two findings? They're not under $1,000. Both verdicts would say that.
Both verdicts might say that if the question on the second count for the under $1,000 in public funds counts had been separated out into two questions. And if that had been the case, we probably wouldn't have that problem. If it had said under $1,000 and public funds, and the jury had checked no to the $1,000. But the problem is that this was a compound question, and we don't know what the jury meant by checking that box, by checking the box no. Without speculation, which is the what the Minnesota Supreme Court has said we can't do in Perkins.
To find the defendant guilty on the odd numbered counts, there was no requirement that the funds stolen be public funds, correct?
For the funds over $35,000? That's correct, Your Honor.
All right.
The state asks this court to look to the status after the court ordered judgments of acquittal on the seven lesser counts. And that is not the correct inquiry. There is no support for this, and the state doesn't offer any support or cite any support. Moore and Christensen and the other cases cited in the briefs make clear that we look to the jury's findings in the case. Moore, for example, says we are unable to reconcile the jury's findings that the defendant caused the death of his wife with premeditation and intent, and at the same time caused the death through negligence or reckless conduct. Christensen from this court similarly focuses on the jury's findings. This court stated, the jury's findings that the defendant is not guilty of misuse is not inconsistent with a guilty finding on another count. The dicta in Christensen actually supports Ms. Brown's argument. This court reasoned that finding an appellant guilty of misuse in an amount more than $1,000 and less than $5,000 necessarily precluded a finding that he was guilty of misuse over $5,000. And that's at page 651 of the opinion. This court in that statement was making clear that the verdicts would have been inconsistent if the jury had found Mr. Christensen guilty of both under and over $5,000. But that's what happened in this case. The jury found Ms. Brown guilty both over $35,000 and under $1,000. So the verdicts were inconsistent in this case. Case law makes clear that the proper remedy for inconsistent verdicts is a new trial, not dismissing some counts. The trial court's remedy to grant judgments of acquittal on the lesser offenses did not solve the problem here. The problem with the inconsistent verdicts is that if the jury finds elements that negate each other, we don't know whether the jury actually found the defendant guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. And we cannot leave verdicts in place where the jury rendered legally inconsistent verdicts. That is why Moore makes clear that the remedy is a new trial. Nothing in the statutes or case law permits the remedy that was ordered in this case to vacate just the lesser offenses. If there's no further questions, I can move on to the sentencing issue. The trial court abused its discretion by relying on facts from other counts to sentence Ms. Brown to an upward departure on count one. The state had requested an upward durational departure based upon the factor of major economic offense. Under this factor, a departure is permitted if two or more enumerated facts are proved. Three factors found by the court here are multiple incidents per victim, that the offense involved a loss substantially greater than the minimum specified in the statute, and that the offense occurred over a lengthy period of time. The Minnesota Supreme Court made clear in Thompson that conduct underlying one offense cannot be used to support an upward departure for a separate conviction. And the rationale in Thompson was to prevent unjust double punishment. The court in this case did this for at least two of the factors. For multiple incidents per victim, the court said there were lots. I did not count up the total number on the spreadsheet of false claims or inaccurate claims, but it was substantial, highly substantial.
Well, and the spreadsheet on which the district court relied in imposing the sentence, in fact, indicates 256 incidents during the time period of that particular count. Do you have any reason to disagree with that?
The court did not specifically refer to one spreadsheet. There were multiple spreadsheets introduced in this case. So I would disagree with the state's characterization that the court was relying on one spreadsheet solely for count one. That is not what the court said in this case. The court simply said that it was looking at a spreadsheet. It didn't count up the total number. So since the court did not state that it was looking only at the facts alleged on count one, the statement suggests that it was looking to the entirety of the claims. For the lengthy period of time factor, the court said the first false claim occurred on October 9th of 2012, and the last one in this complaint was December 29th of 2015. Clearly there, the court was relying on the entire, the conduct alleged in the entire complaint and not just count one.
But if you read, you know, I read the district court sentencing discussion on the record, and I think the context suggests that, in fact, the court knew it was only going to upwardly depart with respect to count one. During the course of the trial, obviously count one dealt with thefts that occurred during a certain period of time. And the spreadsheets, the information presented, do you deny that during that period of time, in fact, the theft losses greatly exceeded $35,000? I think we're north of $100,000. And that there were more than 250 incidents during the period of time that count one encompassed.
I would agree with you, Your Honor, that there were multiple incidents and that there were, that it could be a lengthy period of time.
However, and the court was careful to say, I'm only doing an upward departure with respect to the sentence for count one, the conviction on count one. So why should we assume that the court, in fact, didn't do that and relied on incidents of theft and the amount stolen during the periods of time encompassed in the other counts?
Based upon the court's language, the court was certainly not precise about what it was doing. It did mention count one in reference to the amount, but did not mention just count one in reference to the other two. And again, for the lengthy period of time factor, clearly the court was relying on the entire span of time. It specifically said the first false claim occurred in October 2012, the last occurred in December 2015. So the court was clearly relying on the entire span of time for the lengthy period of time. The state relies on Reich, which is a non-precedential opinion from 2008 that interprets the Supreme Court's decision in Thompson. There's a couple problems with it. First, Reich is distinguished. The district court in Reich made very clear findings that it was only relying on the facts related to the two counts that it departed on. It specifically said in Reich, or the district court said, that there were 78 counts for 78 instances for count six and 70 for count seven. For the factor of amount substantially over the minimum, it specifically said, I'm relying on the $211,000 for count six and the $292,000 for count seven, where the threshold amount was $35,000. There was no such finding here. I'd also like to point out in Thompson, the district court did refer to the individual counts for the factors of multiple incidents and the amount substantially greater than $35,000. And it still wasn't sufficient in that case. In Thompson, the district court expressly stated there are multiple incidents in each count where the departure was taken. It expressly stated in the counts where it departed that the amounts were over $70,000 for those individual counts. So I believe that this suggests that Reich was wrongly decided. But even if this court determines that Reich was correctly decided, that Reich is distinguished based upon the court's lack of specificity regarding the two factors. The trial court improperly relied upon facts underlying other counts to depart upward, and Ms. Brown asked this court to remand for resentencing. Thank you.
Any other questions from the panel? Okay. Thank you very much, Ms. Martin. So we've reset the clock, and counsel for respondent, we're ready for you.
Good morning. May it please the court and counsel, I'm Nick Wonka. I represent the respondent, state of Minnesota, and I am asking this court to affirm the appellant's conviction, affirm the appellant's sentence, and affirm the appellant's the restitution order in this matter. I'll first respond to the inconsistent verdicts argument here made by the appellant. First, the court has to answer as a threshold question, was the jury's verdict actually a valid guilty verdict? The jury returned guilty verdict forms, but indicated on those forms that the state hadn't proven a necessary element of the value. That's what the district court found. That was the reason for granting the judgment of acquittal. If that is not a guilty verdict, valid guilty verdict, as the district court found and has not been appealed, then we have the situation where the question is, can judge findings of acquittal be inconsistent with a guilty verdict? And the answer to that is firmly no, it cannot. Based on the jury's, with the information that they indicated on the special verdict forms and the district court's conclusion that the necessary element hadn't been proven, I think that's a correct finding by the district court, that a necessary element hadn't been proven. That is an acquittal on the merits. It is a resolution in the defendant's favor, and it's not a valid guilty verdict. So what then the court is again left with is guilty verdicts on some counts, acquittals on another. And the Supreme Court's been clear that those cannot be legally inconsistent verdicts. With that, if the court does see those as two guilty verdicts, valid guilty verdicts on the both odd numbered and even numbered counts, and finds based on the jury's answer, the remedy is still not a new trial. They are not, you know, the state's argued that they are legally, they're logically inconsistent at most, not legally inconsistent. And that's because, I think, as the appellant pointed out, the compound question, I think we both agreed that it is a compound question, and we don't know what the jury said with respect to what element wasn't proven, whether it was the amount being under 1,000 or the public funds. But with that, this court can't speculate about it. So it could have been the public funds or the threshold amount. And the court shouldn't speculate. And those are logically inconsistent, but not legally inconsistent verdicts. With that, if the court doesn't have any questions on the verdicts, I would move on to the sentencing. Okay. Turning to the sentencing here, the district court didn't abuse its discretion in issuing an upward departure. First, the district court was very clear in the transcript that it found the major economic offenses apply to each of the counts. On page 60 of the transcript, it made a finding that the state has properly proven beyond a reasonable doubt at least one aggravating factor of major economic offense exists for each of these counts. So it exists for count one, which it imposed the upward departure on, but it also exists for the other counts. It then very clearly said when it imposed its sentence that it was only issuing an upward departure on count one to, in its words, avoid a confusing sentencing order.
That's where I'm confused. And I think that there's merit to the appellant's suggestion that the district court was not as clear as it could have been as to what universe of facts, if you will, it relied on to impose an upward departure with respect to count one, not the other counts. How can we reconcile the district court's sweeping statements that you just referenced about, yes, there would be departure grounds for all of these, with the fact that it must, under the law, limit its determination of an upward sentence on count one to facts associated with count one?
Thank you. So yes, I agree the district court could have been clear about what it was doing, but it did clearly pronounce on page 34 of the transcript that the loss amount far exceeded the minimum in statute. So that is one of the two facts that it has to find. It then has to find a second one. That's whether it's multiple incidents or a lengthy period of time. It did find that there were multiple incidents per victim. It didn't go through the exact counts, but it said there were lots. And then it said, the district court said that they did not count them up, but that it was substantial, highly substantial. I think when the court views that statement in context with its later statement that it's applying, that it's making findings that the state has properly proven the major economic offense on each of the counts, that when it views those together and it makes a finding of multiple incidents per victim on all the counts, and then it says that it is making the finding of the major economic offense being present in each count, each being all of the ones of conviction, I think when it views those together, that's a finding by the district court that within count one, there were multiple incidents per victim for that specific count. And when we have multiple incidents per victim and the loss greater than 35,000, that's enough for an upward departure as a major economic offense. The lengthy period of time, again, the district court, as the appellant correctly points out, did reference the entire time frame when it addressed that. It spoke about it in the context of all the counts. But again, it made, you know, going back to making the finding specific that there's a major economic offense for each of the counts, as it said, and I would all, while it's only a month here, this is an offense that occurs a little bit at a time every day. And in this court's opinion in State versus O'Brien, there were six separate theft by swindle counts where the defendant was sentenced, and that occurred in a 3-month period of time. In the Court of Appeals opinion in that case, it referenced the entire timeframe as being the reason that it affirmed a lengthy period of time. Granted, I don't dispute that there has to be a finding in each specific individual count. My point is that if 3 months can justify a lengthy period of time in O'Brien for 6 counts, 1 month here of these offenses can justify a lengthy period of time in this case. So I think if the court reviews the transcript as a whole, it's clear what the district court was finding. It was finding facts supporting a major economic offense in each isolated count, and then only pronouncing it sentencing on count one. It could have been clear, but that's what the district court's findings show here. And even if the district court did not, you know, improperly or didn't pronounce sufficient findings on one of the facts for a major economic offense, it only has to find two of them. So it did clearly find the loss amount. If the court believes that there's insufficient evidence in the record to justify the finding of the lengthy period of time, the multiple incidents would still be present, and there'd still be two facts supporting a major economic offense, which would justify the district court's decision to depart. It also, I believe the record makes clear that it intended to issue a upward departure. The district court very clearly said that this was a major economic crime and that it was only pronouncing sentence on count one for, again, its belief that it would create a confusing sentencing order to pronounce it on all the counts. But with that, there is sufficient evidence in the record to show that the district court did not abuse its discretion in issuing this upward departure. It did not err as a matter of law. It did not make any legal errors in doing so, and it did not rely on counts or on conduct outside of count one to issue its departure. Does the panel have any questions on the sentencing issue? No.
Looks like we don't. Go ahead.
All right. I would otherwise ask the court to affirm the district court's restitution order, because in the order, the district court did explicitly address the appellant's ability to pay. It did comply with Wiggum. It mentioned on page 4 of the order the appellant's ability to work in the future after her release from prison. This is a sufficient indication that it considered her ability to pay. There's no need to remand to comply with the requirements of Wiggum.
Did the court include in the restitution order any suggestion that a payment schedule or a structure would be set up? And doesn't the law require that?
It does require that. It does require that a payment schedule be set forth. That was not included in the order. So the court could issue, there hasn't been requested by the appellant a limited remand for that. However, the court could do that. I think it addressed that issue in an opinion that came out subsequent to Wiggum. I believe it was the Cloutier opinion. I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing that, but it did address what to do when there is no payment structure ordered. And there does not appear to be one. I haven't found one in the record here about what the appellant is expected to pay on a monthly basis. So there could be a limited remand for that purpose. And with that, if the panel has any other questions about the brief, I'm happy to answer them now. Otherwise, I would ask that the court affirm the appellant's conviction, her sentence, and the restitution order.
Thank you, counsel. It appears that the panel doesn't have any questions for you. We very much appreciate your arguments. We are resetting the clock now for rebuttal time. And counsel for appellant, you can begin your rebuttal if you choose.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would just like to point out that on page 60, there is nothing in the language that suggests that the court is limiting its consideration of the aggravating factor to the facts alleged in count one. It does not say, for example, that each count standing alone has facts that support the aggravating factor. It's not nearly as specific as the language in Thompson. In Thompson, the court specifically said, in the last count, there were hundreds of incidents that could have been charged, many, many thefts over $2,500. There were many, many incidents beyond what was needed either for theft over $2,500 or over $35,000. That's true in each of these counts, even without the multiple incidents. So the court in Thompson made much more specific findings than the court did in this case, and that was still not sufficient, the Supreme Court held in Thompson. Unless there are any other questions, for all of the reasons stated in Ms. Brown's brief, and I would ask this court to reverse her conviction or, in the alternative, remand for resentencing. Thank you.
It looks like no further questions from the panel. Thank you very much, Ms. Martin. I appreciate your comments today. Same to you, Mr. Wonka. Thank you. This court very much values the opportunity to hear from the lawyers in this case, and it is now submitted to us for our decision. We will issue a written decision within the statutory timeframe.